O'Connor bought an automobile. He took his sweetheart for a ride one Sunday. Johnny was togged up in his best Sunday clothes. She nestled close to his side. Things went just dandy till he got down the road. Then something happened to the old machinery. That engine got his goat, off went his hat and coat. Everything needed repairs. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. A dozen times they'd start to hug and kiss, and then the darned old engine, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. Millionaire Wilson said to Johnny one day, your little sweetheart don't appreciate you. I have a daughter who is hungry for love. She likes to ride every day. Johnny had visions of a million in gold. He took her riding in his little auto. But every time that he went to say marry me, 'twas the old story again. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. Every time that he would reach for a kiss, it seems a darned old spark plug, it would miss. And then he'd have to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile. He'd have to get under, get out and get under, to fix his little machine. He was just dying to cuddle his queen. But every minute, when he'd begin it, he'd have to get under, get out and get under. Then he'd get back at the wheel. It seems that once she sat down on his knee, and then he lost control, ran right up a tree. And then he had to get under, get out and get under, and fix up his automobile.
Good evening. Bernie Golias here, the host of The Auto Era, the weekly show that everybody's looking forward to. And what a beautiful day it is. And I hope that you're doing some yard work and you're not stopping doing that yard work and maybe taking a little break listening to The Auto Era. But this is the last show we're going to do for a while because the times are changing for this facility. So we'll see how this goes in the near future. But the Auto Air won't be on next week, or for a few weeks, maybe in a month or two at this time. So we'll be more than likely reprogramming for the fall. But other than that, you could listen to all the old shows that we had, the past shows, on a website that is being put together. And that's simply called TheAutoEra.com. So go to www.autotheautoera.com and you can listen to some of the shows. I think we got two or three of the shows up now. They're being archived and there'll be pretty close to 20 shows on there. So it'll be very educational and you can still call me and email me and we can still communicate regarding automobile history. We've always focused on the Northeast Ohio, Cleveland, and Northern Ohio automobiles. But, of course, we did talk, as you know, about everything from all over the country and all over the world. But that, anyway, let's get this mic a little bit closer here. And, you know, we had a good time. It was a really great time since September. We talked about the history of Cleveland and Northern Ohio and the automotive roots. And we talked occasionally about some worldwide adventures when we got into Bentley and Rolls-Royce. And, you know, that the purpose of the show was to expose the accomplishments of what Cleveland and local communities had to offer during the birth of the automotive industry. So we are going to continue doing that through the website. And I'll probably be interviewing people throughout the summer and putting that up on the website and going from there, too, so we can communicate. So don't worry about that. And as you know, historically, we've always talked about having about 115 cars made in Northeast Ohio and 540 in the state of Ohio. So we have a lot of repertoire, a lot of things to talk about in the future, and just, you know, let's keep in touch. So it was great to be able to do this, and quite an experience, and I'm glad that we had a lot of calls come in, and people are listening to the show. Anyway, again, the show is called The Auto Era, and this is WOBC Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And one thing of interest that took place this weekend, as you know, I'm involved heavily with the Antique Automobile Club of America. I'm the president of the Ohio region, and this weekend we had a nice spring tour, which was down in New Philadelphia, Ohio. And that, if you ever want to get more interest in this, if you have an old car, even if you don't have an old car, if you want to just get involved with a nice group of people to be able to check out some of the sites in Ohio that you normally would never see, because a lot of it's in your own backyard and you don't even know it's there, this is one way to do it. So I was down in New Philadelphia and then went off to Columbus for some other adventure. And then we had a banquet. Is very nice. So keep that in mind when you want to get involved with the Antique Automobile Club. And you can always email me at BernieGoliath@AOL.com and get some information, or look it up at AAC. That's Antique Automobile Club of America, AACA.org. And if you're not a member, you can get on that forums and talk to people from all over the world if you're looking for some special parts or whatever the case, and you can communicate with everybody. So, what happened today that was interesting is I went to drive my 22 Winton, and I just wanted to go up to the corner because I was doing some work on it, and it was running real nice, and so I thought I'd take our dog, who is, his name is Winton, and for those who don't know him, you can call him Mr. Winton. But he's a corgi, and he loves going for a ride. So Winton went for a ride in the Winton. He likes to get some treats. So I just went up to get the supplies or something, and then it wasn't too far away from home. And for some reason, it just started overheating, and the next thing you know, it was water everywhere, and the car stalled out right in the middle of an intersection. Luckily, it was in the country. So I had to push the car out of the way, and then some angelic divine intervention, whatever took place, appeared with a pickup truck and says, "Do you need any help?" And I wasn't going to say no. So next thing I know, we had to tie a rope to the front bumper and towed me home. Well, luckily, I wasn't too far away. So I don't know what's wrong with it. That was just happened a couple hours ago before the show. And I think it's just, well, who knows what it is. It could be anything. But we'll check that out and get it ready, because we're going to do a lot of running around this summer. We've got a lot of good shows to go to, and that's what time it is. It's time to go to the car shows. So let's talk a little bit about cars, too. And one thing about car shows, we'll talk about this, too, on and off throughout the show, is we're going to be having, as I mentioned, I believe, last week and a few weeks in the past, the All-Stars, Cleveland All-Star Show. And that's going to be on June 13th. Actually, it's from the 12th to the 14th. And on the 13th, we're going to have the show at Ursuline College, and we are inviting automobiles and vehicles, all types of vehicles, made in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, Northern Ohio. And should be a very unique show. That's what we want. We want a unique show out of this. And, of course, there's a lot of different car clubs that are going to, you know, come and, you know, park their old cars in respect of their fellows' cars that were built here in Cleveland. So, I mean, if you have an old car, you know, 57 Chevy, a 1980 Honda, or whatever the case may be, please drive it up to Ursuline College, and we'll have a special place for you to park, and people can admire your vehicle. So keep that in mind. And we've got a lot of activities. Friday night, we're going to be doing a little cookout at the Templar Building. Dave Buehler is going to be giving a talk on his collection on the Templars. And then there's going to be various driving tours, you know, self-guided. But the Antique Automobile Club will provide that. And you can go at your own risk, so to speak. There's a lot to see. And the Crawford's going to be involved. The Western Reserve Historical Society is going to be, is definitely involved. They're collaborating with the Antique Automobile Club. And we have a very nice show. So keep that in mind for June 13th. And if you need to have any questions, please email me at BernieGolias@AOL.com. Anyway, we have a guest here tonight as well. As we always have a guest. Well, not always. There was a few shows that I did solo, and I talked a lot about Winton and Cleveland history. But tonight is the last show for a while, like I say, and one of my special guests that has been on about three times already, maybe four, this might be his fourth time, and he loves it, and he's a great guest to have on the show, and that's Roy Pacini. And Roy Pacini and I are going to do a little bit of talking about Cleveland cars, and you know, and you can call in and join us at 440-775-8139. And please be patient if you can't get through. That's just because there's so many calls coming in, it probably jams the phones, and we only have one line. So, you know, be patient. But anyway, thank you so much. And thank you for your patronage for the whole the last 6, 8, 7 months or so. But anyway, here's Roy Pacini, and we're going to start to talk a little bit about Cleveland cars. Please give us a call.
Well, thank you very much for having me back, and I really appreciate it. And it's the fifth time, for the record. It's the fifth time I've been on. Tonight, I prepared a little bit on Cleveland cars that are called Cleveland. We actually had quite a representation through the years flying the Cleveland banner. And a lot of the companies just came and went. They were, for the most part, little fly-by-night things that were somebody's idea that they tried to put through. And, you know, as often happens, you know, in the first year or two, things tend to collapse and companies go out of business, a lot of bankruptcies in the first couple of years. But a lot of people had a lot of faith in the name Cleveland. And Cleveland had a total of 9 vehicles of different natures named after it. The first one was an electric car. There were 2 electric cars that were made in Cleveland with the name Cleveland. And there was a tricycle and a slew of others with a total of 9 different brands holding the name Cleveland. The first car was the Cleveland Electric. It was invented by a man by the name of Elmer Sperry. And Sperry invented the Sperry gyroscope, which was used in a lot of navigation equipment. And he became quite rich and quite famous. And eventually, he was one of the founders of the Sperry Rand Company, which was quite a big company. And he was a good friend of Thomas Edison's and quite an innovator and a rather brilliant inventor.
Did you, not to interrupt, yes, but if anybody has any of the Cleveland types of historical homes, they'll show, I think, a huge gyroscope that was in his backyard off of Euclid Avenue. And that was one thing that he invented.
Yeah, he was one of the early movers and shakers of the Cleveland economy, and he wanted to enter the automobile industry, and he did it with an electric car, and supposedly he had a 100-mile range on the vehicle with a top speed of 18 miles an hour. And in 1899 to 1901, in which he made the cars, it had a top speed of 18, and it brought the princely sum of $2,200 on the top end for the most fitted out version, which was a huge amount of money at that point in time. He had the car made. He subcontracted the manufacturer of the car. A company called the Cleveland Machine Screw Company actually made it. And they got bought out by the American Bicycle Company, which owned another car, another brand of electric car called the Waverly Electric. And they basically just blended the two electric cars together under the name Waverly. And they did that car didn't last very long either. But it was, you know, the first foray into the automobile venue for the name Cleveland. The second vehicle was a tricycle called the Cleveland Tricycle. It was made by the H.A. Lozier Company, and they were a bike manufacturer, and they made a three-wheeled vehicle, and they actually made 100 of them, and they sold for $350 a unit. Didn't last long. Once again, they only made them 1 year, and Lozier, you know, was an automobile manufacturer as well, and they, you know, moved out to Plattsford, New York, and they eventually were part of the ancestry of the Cleveland-made Chandler automobile as well.
And also, if the engineer for that, if you go down to Crawford and you see a Cleveland and Chandler, you look at the hood and the radiator design, it looks almost like a Lozier. So that some of that still was in that lineage from the engineers that did work there.
Yeah, a lot of the people went from one company to another. A lot of the ideas were swapped back and forth, and a lot of, as has been discussed on this show many times, a lot of the component manufacturers made parts for all the different vehicles, and a lot of the cars were assembled cars that used readily available parts that were, you know, almost universal in some instances across the across the board. I mean, if you go and you look at some of the early Cleveland-made automobiles, you'll see the same fenders on one car as you would on another. I mean, the fenders that go on my Winton are the same fenders that you'll see on some of Dave Buehler's Templars. They were, you know, bought from
close.
A bit different dimensions.
Well, here's something that is here's, you know, you're right about that, about the sheet metal, or some sheet metal fenders and things like that were generic. The frames were generic.
Yes.
You know, Parrish and Bingham. Parrish and Bingham right across the street from Glidden Paint and Winton Motor Carriage Company, motor car company, right on Berea Road. They made the frames for just about every car made. And then, of course, if you go into the motors, you got Lycoming, you got Continental. Continental motor was probably in, I would say, 50% of these oddball cars, and then there was others motors as well.
But, yeah, the Continentals went into a lot of big name vehicles, and you mentioned Lycoming. I mean, Lycoming made all the engines for Auburn's, Cords, and Duesenberg's. They were a huge company. They still exist. They're still in production. I believe they make either jet or industrial engines. They were a survivor. And a lot of these vehicles used their own technology for the engines in a lot of cases, but in some cases you did have, you know, purchased engines as well. It's an easy thing to do to assemble things out of pieces, parts, and people were doing it in the beginning of the industry, and they're still doing it today.
Well, you know, Roy, when you're talking about that, you're thinking of, for one example, you know, you have Gabriel horns and then hydraulic shock absorbers.
Cleveland products.
Cleveland. Right, exactly. And, you know, Charles Thompson, I mentioned this, I think, last week and a couple other times in the past. Charles Thompson began making valves for Winton engines as early as 1904. So, you know, the Winton went out and actually, Winton actually made everything. I mean, I think everything, including the spark plugs in the really pre-dawn era. He did get some examples of spark plugs, which we call spark plugs now. Champion, obviously, was the first one that really really made a spark plug the way we're familiar with it. But you know, the porcelainized spark plug Ford used in his early racers. Actually, Winton was using those and got some of those from Ford as early as 1901 because Ford had them in his race cars. And then we get into this history too. You know, this is what we're debating, and not debating, but at least sharing. You know, Henry Ford really did not have a good steering system. And you know, the very famous race in October 10th, 1901, Grosse Pointe, Michigan. There's communication between Ford and Winton about Winton wanted to get some of his porcelainized sparking devices, and Ford obviously assisted him with that. And Ford really did not have good steering mechanisms, and then after that race, you know, Winton did send him, Henry Ford, that is, Winton did send Henry Ford a complete steering mechanism to put on his race car.
Well, I believe the race car had a very dangerous system.
Yeah, it was extremely dangerous. I mean, you push the car one way, let's say you have to steer you're on your steering wheel, turn it maybe a quarter turn just to make it move.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was so much slop in it, but anyway, there is proof to that, because there is letters out there that say that Winton will be sending Ford his steering mechanisms and there is holes drilled in the chassis to show where the old steering mechanism was.
It still exists in the Ford Museum.
Yeah, it's still there. So I mean, it's those things, you know, are not lost through history, but. To confirm it, but when you look at, like you were saying, a lot of these car manufacturers initially, Winton especially, made everything himself, and then they started, as their business started to grow, then they started, getting it from other sources, and that's how basically TRW got started with
Thompson Ramo Williams.
Yeah, and then the Torbenson Gear and Axle got started in Cleveland, and it became Eaton, and then other Lubrisol was just a bunch of people from the Case Western Reserve graduates, and they started, you know, tinkering with chemistry and different oils and different brands and making it work a lot better for the cars. And you know, that was in the late 20s, though, when Lubrizol came out of the picture. But yeah, but see, you know, Continental Engines, I know my brother-in-law used to have a 1912 Gabriel. That had a Continental engine in it. That was sold off, and then the gentleman that has it now, I think, is going to bring it to the Cleveland show coming up, the Gabriel 1912. It's the only one that exists, the only one that, and I found it here, and it was in Cleveland a few years ago. But anyway, Roy, I just... wanted to interject that, and that's
well, the components, yeah. the manufacture of components, even today is a gargantuan business. The aftermarket, as well as, you know, the primary components, and oddly enough, that leads us into our next Cleveland automobile, the Cleveland Motor Car Company. It was actually made by the Federal Manufacturing Company, which had factories in Cleveland and Elyria. And they made a whole slew of different models. They actually were in business making Cleveland cars for about 5 years. They forayed into the automobile market, the complete automobile market, for a few years. And they made actually very high-priced cars for the time. They were in business from 1904 to 1909, and they made cars varying in price from $2,800 to $4,000, which was exceptional, you know, money at the time. And they won all kind of different endurance challenges and the typical, road races. And they competed quite extensively for the time. And they had sales offices in, you know, various cities. They had them in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Milwaukee, St. Louis, and San Francisco. And some of the cars even made their way overseas. So they actually did have quite a nice little production going. going, and they were located on the Near East Side, East 12th and St. Clair, and they put out quite a bit of production for the time, because a lot of these companies were very small. But Federal Manufacturing, the manufacturing company, they were one of the early aftermarket component makers, and if I'm not mistaken, I think they still exist today in the form of Federal Mogul. I may be wrong on that point, but I believe it is still the same lineage in the company. And then there was another Cleveland company at the same, just a little bit preceding that. There was the Cleveland Machine Screw Manufacturing Company, which also was involved in the manufacture of the Cleveland Electric. They got into making a gasoline automobile, and they made a one cylinder and a two cylinder model. They made a Roadster for about $750, and a two cylinder one, which had opposed horizontal cylinders, and that one went for about $1,750, and they were made in the city of Cleveland, and oddly enough, they were sold through department stores. People don't realize it, but early on, a lot of cars were sold through things like Sears, and in this case, it was the Rothschild department store chain. They actually marketed them. It was a way of, you know, distribution. When it came to the parts, obviously this would have been a car that would have had backup support with parts distribution, also through the department store.
Go ahead. We're going to do a little station break. Finish up on that and go.
Well, that we'll just leave it at that for this particular brand of Cleveland car, because the next one's going to be involved Chandler.
Okay, well, we're going to come back here shortly. We're going to do a little PSA here. And first of all, you're listening to the Auto Era, WOBC, Oberlin 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio. And this is Bernie Goliath, your host. And we have Roy Pacini on here when we're talking about some Cleveland cars. And this is the last show we're going to be doing for this semester. And so we'll be back here shortly. Let's give a listen here, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Ah, there's that horn now. You know I'm wild about horns. An automobile that goes ta-ta-ta-ta. I don't know what there is about one, but you can't get a girl without one. I ain't had a girlfriend for many a night. Since I got that bugle, I'm doing all right. I'm wild about horns on automobiles that go ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta.
Welcome back. Bernie Golias here, your host to the Auto Era, the show that has the most history, that is, of the automobiles made in Northeast Ohio. And this is 91.5 FM Oberlin College and Community Radio, WOBC. But anyway, this is going to be the last show for the semester, and we'll be back a few weeks from now, or maybe a couple months, actually, because I think we'll be starting to show up again sometime in early September. The summer semester is long, and it's a different scenario here, but if you want to listen to past shows, we have a website, and it's called TheAutoEra.com, www.TheAutoEra.com, and we're putting up the various shows that were recorded, archiving them, and that should be of interest to you. And then, of course, this summer I'll probably be putting up some additional interviews. So if you want to keep in touch, you can give me an email, a note at Bernie Golias, BERNIEGOLIAS, at AOL.com. We have our guest, Roy Pacini, here this evening. He's been on a show, as he said, five times over the last 6 months or so. And we always welcome him back because he is a wealth of knowledge, and it's always a pleasure to talk with him. So we're going to talk a little bit more about some Cleveland cars, and we'll mention some more other than maybe some that you have never heard of before. So, Roy, take it away. Let's hear some about more Cleveland cars.
Well, a car that was made in Cleveland that not many people would know about today, but it was a very popular car at the time, was the Chandler. It was made here in Cleveland. They actually, at one point in time, about 1920, they were producing 23,000 cars a year, and they had a subsidiary that they started called the Cleveland Car, and they made as many as 16,000 Clevelands in a year at the same time. So you had a production coming out of Cleveland of almost 40,000 cars from the Chandler factory, which compared to Ford might not be much, but as far as the competition, those were big numbers in 1920. And Chandler was a upper middle class car. It was it was expensive for the time, but it was not quite at the level of a Peerless or a Winton or one of a Pierce Arrow or anything like that. It was more like it would occupy the place maybe of about a Buick today, but it was still pricey for the time. They went for anywhere from about $1,600 to $2,800. They were expensive, but they weren't the really ultra end. Chandler made the engine. They made their own products of the engine and axles, and subcontracted the rest. The entire rest of the car was made by somebody else. The bodies were made by Fisher Body in Detroit. And once production got big enough, they actually opened up a Fisher Body here in Cleveland. They put up a six-story building about East 140th Street and Coit Road. The building still exists today. And they made bodies for Chandler and for the Cleveland. The Cleveland was Chandler's foray into the lower end market. They were essentially a very similar car made, but with the same basic components. A little bit of differentiation, difference in wheelbase. The Chandler had a longer wheelbase at about 123 inches, and the Cleveland had a 112-inch wheelbase. So it was a little bit smaller, and they put a little bit extra flourish on the components of the Chandler, but they were quite successful with them. And eventually, as the 20s wore on, they came out with things like the one-shot lubrication system. Lubricating an early car was a big deal. You had all kind of grease cups, all kind of oil ports that you had to regularly oil, or the components would seize up. And a one-shot lubrication, where you'd push a pedal or push a handle and lubricate the chassis, was a big deal in those days, because most cars didn't have anything like that.
Well, Bijur was one of the biggest.
Bijur,
for oiling systems.
Yeah, that was
not only that in oiling systems, but they made generators and starters and everything else.
Electrical components, but those systems were used on everything from a Duesenberg to a Rolls Royce to, you know, a lot of the domestic American cars. They had quite a niche in the market, but they were a little bit innovative in their approach in the Chandler and Cleveland cars. Chandler eventually absorbed its subsidiary in 1926, and eventually as the 20s came to an end, the Hupp Motor Manufacturing Corporation, bought Chandler and absorbed it into their conglomerate.
And they did make Hupp Mobiles, if you're leading into that, here in Cleveland.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did. That was probably the association that, you know, led to the acquisition. And Hupp Mobiles continued on for quite a number of years after that. I don't know offhand when Hupp went out of business, but there are still quite a number of them out there. There's still a few Chandlers out there too, and some Clevelands. It's one of the cars that you're most likely to see compared to, you know, some of the more obscure Cleveland makes. We have a number of vehicles that'll be coming to the show at Ursuline College. Hopefully we'll get a Chandler or two, as well as maybe even a Cleveland.
Oh, we will. Yes, we do have some of those coming.
Good. To go on with the last couple, and these will go rather quickly, there was the Cleveland Cycle Car. It was a one-year deal. It was made in 1914. It had motorcycle-type engine. A cycle car was a small little, almost like a go-kart kind of apparatus. It ran on motorcycle wheels, and they would usually have a two-cylinder motorcycle-style engine in them. The Cleveland had a four-cylinder, and it was on a 96-inch wheelbase, and it had a friction drive in it, much like a Carter car, which was talked about on this show previously, or one of your lawnmowers that has the a little wheel that rubs it up against another wheel, which applies friction and generates the power to propel the vehicle. And that's how the Cleveland Cycle Car ran. And like I said, it was only a one-year deal, and it was a rather limited production affair. And we'll go on to another vehicle called the Cleveland Electric once again. It was made by the Cuyahoga Motor Car Company, and it was intended to be a taxi cab company. They wanted to make electrical taxi cabs. They made a couple of cars that ended up being passenger cars, and then they decided they didn't want to do that, and they went on to manufacture batteries. So that was another in and out deal. And then there was the Cleveland Auto Cab, which was made in Geneva, Ohio, and they actually made quite a few of these. It was started by a man by the name of Lewis Moores, who actually designed Peerless and Moon automobiles. And he was quite a big name at the time and had a lot of pull. And he started the company, and they eventually were bought out by another automobile manufacturing company called Ewing Motors, which made a lot of taxi cabs. And that eventually got bought out by GM and integrated into the system and eventually closed down. So I believe that was all 9 Cleveland-named automobiles and vehicles.
Well, one of the things I just wanted to mention is in regards to the Hupp Mobile and the Chandler cars, they basically ended making those in Cleveland in 1929. And Hupp Mobile began making the 1930 Hupp Mobile 6, which had been the Chandler plant, and that was at East 131st Street, and so that's where they basically made them, and they converted that to make Hupp Mobile bodies there, and acquired parts from Fosteria, Ohio, which were completely retooled. So when you look at that, I believe the cars they were only made there for, you know, not too long, about a year or so, because the Hupp Mobile made the bodies at the former Cleveland Automobile plant on Euclid Avenue through October about 1934, and the cars continued to be made in Detroit up until about 1940. So it's
so we lost another production company to a foreign city.
Right on.
It sounds typical of today.
Well, there's a lot of different cars, you know, a lot of oddballs. I mean, when you really talk about them, you know, you can go to different books and do all the research on this, too. There's a lot of good books out there. Golden Wheels is probably one of the Bibles for Cleveland cars. And, a lot, you know, you can do research on it quite a bit on the Internet now where you couldn't do it years ago, but... you know, when you start thinking of a lot of these oddballs, I mean, some of these cars are like the Gaith and the Star and the... well, actually, one popular one was the Royal Tourist. That was a very high-end car.
The Crawford Auto Museum
Yes.
has one. Beautiful car.
They used to, but they don't have it anymore, do they? I don't think they do.
It might be one that was deacquisitioned.
Right, because Royal Tourist, that was really a high-end car, and that was made here in Cleveland from 1903 to 1912. Of course, we all know the most popular ones, you know, but when you start getting into people's names, like, you know, like the Byrider and DeMars and the Ewig, Ferris, it's not associated with the Ferris wheel. But and Gaith and Steuben Hassent and how many people would want to buy a car? Well, actually, it depends on what part of the world you're from. But the Steuben Hassent, and I'm probably not pronouncing it completely, but it is a. But 1911, 1912 was only around a year, and I guess you can reason why. I mean, try to market that car. How would you like to buy a Steuben Hassent from Cleveland, Ohio? Yet
in the day, you got to remember entrance into the field was a lot easier at that point in time, because back in those days, technology was expensive and labor was cheap. So we had a huge number of metalworking companies here in town. We had lots of foundries, lots of metal stamping organizations, and, you know, industry was going crazy here. So if you had a couple of bucks to pay a couple of helpers, you could go into the business of manufacturing just about anything. Now, today, technology has gotten cheaper and labor has gotten expensive, so we've actually gone to the other end. You can't get into the process of manufacturing anything at a reasonable price anymore, because, you know, just the simple labor cost alone is prohibitive. But that's why we're exporting our jobs to China, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, you thought the Volkswagen was the people's car. Well, they did have a people's car made in Cleveland, and it was made in 1900 and 1902. So if you want to look that one up, people's car.
It was literally called people's car.
It was called a people's, yes.
I wonder if any of them still exist.
I don't think so. I believe it was a steam car. And I believe he sold a couple gasoline ones. And People's Automobile Company.
I'm surprised.
About 1900.
As in love I am with steam automobiles, I'm surprised I've never heard of it. It was probably very limited production.
Very limited.
Well, you know, that's the thing. A lot of these companies, you know, made a few examples and you know, maybe sold a couple of them so they could actually be considered a business. And also, they were a brand of car. And, you know, odds are, you know, the vast majority of the cars that were made here unfortunately became extinct and you know, probably got eaten up by the scrap drives.
Oh, yeah, the scrap drives, when you think about it. I mean, yeah, you were patriotic if you donated your car. And that's where a lot of them went, no doubt about it. But just think of all the really top-notch cars, the Locomobiles, the Peerlesses, the Pierceros, all the ones that had magnesium crankcases. They were the hottest tickets. You probably got $5 for one of those at a scrap drive. And people that owned Duesenbergs, they wanted to make sure that they didn't want that Duesenberg. They wanted to give it to the scrap drive because they felt it was made, now, not the person that may have bought it new, but a used car or something. They thought it was made in Germany, and they wanted to scrap it.
Oh, absolutely.
Brand new.
Anything. Well, even names like Bosch. I mean, you hear Bosch electrical components today, but back during World War I, Bosch, the American company, the American manufacturing arm of Bosch was seized from the Germans, and anything that was made by Bosch here in the United States went under the name American Bosch. I mean, those kind of sentiments ran very strong, And you did have a lot of scrapping. And guys like a man named Barney Pollard up in Michigan did a great service. These people that actually hoarded automobiles. And Pollard had, they claim, up to about 1,200 automobiles in his collection. And he stacked them on end. He set up telephone poles and put train rails across the top of the telephone poles and literally hung the vehicles from these rails. And as a result, people such as yourself, you have a Pollard car, have benefited from his foresight in saving these things. And Henry Ford and Pollard did not get along. Pollard was owed a lot of money for paving. He had a huge paving company, and he was owed a lot of money by Henry Ford for work that he did at the River Rouge plant. And Ford didn't want to pay him, so Ford turned him in as a hoarder of strategic metals to the United States government. And the United States government came, and they tried to get him to scrap everything, and he ended up having negotiations, and he agreed to, you know, take all the tires off of all of his cars and do certain things, scrap certain things, and at the rate of, I believe, either one a week or one a month, he was supposed to turn over one of his antique cars to the Ford Rouge plant to be melted down for the war effort by the Rouge Steel Company. Well, Pollard was no dummy. He just turned in Ford's. And Ford quit talking to the government after that, and Pollard quit turning them in.
Right, and then also Barney Pollard is a gentleman. He would go around looking for old farm equipment. So he would turn in a lot of iron, but a lot of that iron was obsolete farm equipment, horse-drawn items, steam engines, whatever the case may be. Ouch. So he did a lot of that. But yeah, my 1915 Winton four-door limousine was a Bonnie Pollard car. He found it. I did research on it. I don't know where it actually came from. His son is still alive. I think he's in his mid-80s. But I did talk to him a while, you know, when I first acquired a car. I try to do as much research as I can. But hey, if anybody knows anything about the Bonnie Pollard vehicles that were up in Detroit, and my 15 Winton definitely was one of them, give me a buzz. Email me, because it's always good to see some of these cars. And a lot of photographs. His Bonnie Pollard's grandson is very big in history. He wrote a lot of articles in the Antique Automobile. And Dylan, I think, is his last name. And he wrote a lot of articles on the Bonnie Pollard days. And he remembers going in all of those barns, and some of them burned down back in the late 70s or so, early 80s. But he remembers them as a kid. But unfortunately, no one really took a lot of photographs.
Yeah, there are very few pictures of it out there. And you always see the same ones, especially after the fire. And it was a train that went by, and some ashes caught one of the barns on fire, and literally cremated about 100 automobiles. And it was a real tragedy. But I remember when it happened. And Barney Pollard himself was still alive when they auctioned off the collection. He wanted to get it out into the hands of people. And the unfortunate thing was, one of the biggest groups of bidders that came to bid on his collection were scrappers. So there were a number of cars that were lost to scrappers that, you know, literally scrap them out and recycle them.
Yeah.
But a car like yours, I mean, for the people that are listening that don't know, the particular car that Bernie has, had Barney Pollard not saved it, this is one of the largest automobiles of the brass era ever made. I mean, this car is 22 feet long and 8 feet tall. It's gargantuan. And had Barney Pollard not had the foresight to save and actually archive these vehicles for future people's use, something like that would have been totally lost to history, and nobody'd ever have the opportunity. And God only knows how many fabulous pieces of machinery were lost to the war effort. I mean, we won the war, thank God for that. But it, you know, a lot of stuff was just, a lot of history was just wiped out.
Absolutely. And, well, you know, everything keeps getting recirculated. So who knows, if you're driving your 1983 Toyota, or I don't want to say Toyota, but maybe a 19, It could be, because we always send scrap over to Japan and China. But you know where I'm going with this. Yes. You might be driving in a Pierce Arrow, or you might be in a Winton. Maybe part of that fender may have a little lineage in there.
You never know.
From a locomobile or something. Because that, you know, that scrap metal keeps getting reprocessed.
Reused. I mean, who knows? You may be driving in part of a car that, you know, hauled a dignitary like, you know, the president or John D. Rockefeller or God knows who. It's a, you know, even, you know, Bonnie and Clyde, who knows? But a lot of that stuff, you know, disappeared. And, you know, farm machinery, luckily there was a lot of survival rate with the farm machinery, because it was very difficult to access. And, you know, another hobby of mine is, you know, the antique engine hobby and the tractors. And because of the remote rural location of a lot of this stuff, it survived and avoided the scrap drives.
That's true. And, you know, we're going to have a lot of these cars that were made in Cleveland again at our show. And that's going to be June 13th at the Ursuline College and the Antique Automobile Club of America, Northern Ohio Chapter, and the Western Reserve Historical Society, Crawford, will be part of this. And we're going to have some of those cars there. You know, we're going to have a Vulcan, the only Vulcan that exists, a Vulcan Roadster, I think it's a 13, that was made in Painesville. So that's going to be there. It's going to be one of the cars. We're going to have a few Wintons.
Survivor.
Yeah, a few Wintons and
Stearns.
Stearns and
White.
There's going to be white steam cars. I know a 1909 white steam car is going to be there. And I'll have my 22 Winton. I'll have to fix it up a little bit. As you know, need a little fixing today.
Get out and get under.
Get out and get under. That's a fact. We're going to, keep the history going here, and like I say, if you want to, you can listen in on the website, www.theautoera.com.
Before we go, I'd like to put in a little plug for the Antique Automobile Club of America. If anybody has interest in antique automobile clubs, this is the club to join. It's universal. Anything from an 1890-something automobile up to a 1990 vehicle is eligible to enter the club. You don't have to own a car to join the club. Their dues are very reasonable. They put out great publications. And if you have any interest in antique automobiles whatsoever, please join. It's well worth it. You get great value for your money. They have lots of shows, lots of tours, lots of events. And you meet some fabulous people. And we have things here.
You might even meet Roy Pacini and Ernie Goliath.
Yes. And you might survive the experience. Hopefully. Please consider joining the club, because it's a great value for the money. Price-wise, you can't beat it. Anyone from a teenager to an old person could afford the entrance fee to the club. It's very reasonable.
Well, I agree to all of that. But you're listening to WOBC 91.5 FM, Oberlin College and Community Radio, and you're listening to The Auto Era, and we have a few minutes left, and you know, I always sign off with playing a song by the Beatles, Drive Your Car, because it's the perfect time of year now. You know, you want to make sure that you get those cars out there. They are rolling billboards for the hobby. All of them have history behind them, family history or whatever. Those are the kind of things you want to share with people, because it's getting a bit thin out there with the various types of historical vehicles. And we always do appreciate them. We appreciate everything about those cars. So what else you want to have to say there, Roy?
Well, everybody have a great summer and enjoy your vehicles, and patronize the car shows, go to cruise-ins, have a great time.
Sounds pretty good to me. So let's, again, I want to thank everybody for all your patronage. I want to thank everybody for calling in when they did and asking questions. It was a lot of fun, and I look forward to coming back maybe from time to time as maybe do some fill-ins. But, again, you can always listen to us and archives that we're going to have from the show. And, again, thank you very much. It was a lot of fun. It was educational for myself as well. And I'm sure that, I'd like to get feedback from you, too. So thank you again. And Bernie Goliath, the host here, that's me, and I would appreciate everybody that we had in the past, all of our guests. They did a great job, and thank you, Roy, for being on the show for, you know, those last five times, and we'll be back again, I'm sure, here in the near future. So let's get a little bit of the Beatles and drive those cars. Drive them and have a good time. Have a great summer.